Welcome to In Your Brain. I'm a neuroscience student at the University of Florida, and I'm super curious about everything having to do with the brain. Join me to discover what happens
in your brain.
According to the World Stroke Organization, strokes are a leading cause of disability worldwide, and they're the second most common cause of death. Join me in this episode to understand why, what does it mean to have a stroke, and how does it affect what happens in your brain? As always, we have a special guest.
Hello, Christina. My name is Eduardo Candelario. I am associate professor in the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Florida. And my lab actually focuses on studying ischemic stroke.
Okay, first things first. What is a stroke?
Yeah, so basically a stroke, there are different types of a stroke, but generally it's basically the blockage of a main artery in the brain that supplies a large territory of the brain. And there are different types, as I mentioned. One of them is ischemic stroke, which is actually the most common. And it accounts for roughly 90% of all the strokes are ischemic. And this means that the artery has been blocked by a thrombus or an embolus that basically travels from the periphery that lodges in a brain artery.
So like a blood clot?
Like a blood clot. Okay. And could also be produced locally. For example, if there is atherosclerosis or buildup inside the artery and in the brain, and then there is platelets that accumulate in that spot and basically occlude the artery locally. But this is the occlusion or the blockage of the artery is the main cause of ischemic stroke. And the other types is the hemorrhagic stroke, in which basically the vessels burst and there is like hemorrhage and the blood is actually very detrimental and the mortality is really high. And the other type is the mini stroke, which is basically similar to ischemic stroke, but occurs on a very smaller scale in the sense that it's a small artery that is being occluded. A lot of people actually don't even notice, you know, and it can resolve. However, this is like the sign that a full-blown stroke is coming down the road. So these are the main types. Overall, the definition is basically the occlusion of a main artery that supplies the brain and basically produces huge neurological deficits and all that due to the need of oxygen and nutrients by the neurons that are highly dependent on blood supply.
The brain is one of the most metabolically active organs, so this blockage of an artery prevents our neurons from getting the nutrients they need from our blood, which leads to cell death. Where in the brain does this tissue damage happen? Can a stroke occur anywhere?
It can happen in different places because it all depends on the artery that is being occluded, but the most common artery that is actually most of the blood clots from the periphery end up in the middle cerebral artery based on the location of because it travels through the internal carotid artery and it lodges in the middle cerebral artery. And most of the ischemic strokes are actually due to the occlusion of the middle cerebral artery. And this obviously produces large ischemia in the cortex. If you don't do anything about it over time, it actually produces edema, which is water accumulation of water in your brain. Brain is one of the organs that cannot swell compared to other organs because it's confined by the skull. And this increase in mass, overall mass of the tissue, basically compress nerves and brainstem and vital organs, I mean regions of the brain that are needed for survival. And actually, most of the people who die from a stroke is due to edema, to brain swelling. Sometimes they have to do the compressive craniotomy, which is basically remove part of the skull to let the brain swell without, compressing the brain stem and other regions of the brain that are vital for survival. And once the swelling, subsides, then basically they put back the bone, which is wild.
So scary. I know.
It's a very invasive therapy.
I've seen that in Grey's Anatomy.
Yes, the compression.
The middle cerebral artery supplies blood to many cortical areas, including part of the motor cortex, which controls movement for the face, arms, and legs. This is why a common side effect of having a stroke is loss of movement. The tissue around the area of the stroke, called the penumbra, suffers excitotoxic cell death, which just means neurons are overactive and they release way too much glutamate. The blood-brain barrier also becomes damaged, allowing peripheral immune cells, called neutrophils, to enter the brain.
There has been a lot of emphasis on immune response after a stroke, because we know that if we actually intervene and block that initial dysregulated inflammatory response that happens, we can improve outcomes. And we also know that the peripheral immune system, it's actually critical in a stroke injury and recovery, in fact. We know that actually this penumbral tissue, it's being invaded by peripheral immune cells. In particular, the first responders are neutrophils, that they basically come in response to these chemotactic, signals that are coming from the brain, because these neurons basically burst and all this content from inside the neurons are strong inducers of an immune response. This shouldn't be outside, right? That's what the immune system is recognizing. This belongs inside a cell, not outside the cell, right? So then the immune system comes to attack and clean basically that area. This is critical for this establishment of that injury initially. However, later on, we know that macrophages that are monocytes, and they become macrophages when they infiltrate, they actually help to have reparative properties as well. All the immune response is not is biphasic. Basically, you have a detrimental response initially, but you need the delayed inflammation actually is important in the repair, because somebody has to clean these dead neurons, mm-hmm. right? So the monocyte and derived macrophages come to the area and actually phagocyte and basically eat the dead neurons and also the neutrophils that were initially attacking the area. So this is important. In fact, in a lot of the studies that have been shown that if you enhance this macrophage polarization to a reparative phenotype that actually help clean up this debris that is has occurred initially because of the stroke, you enhance a function. So the immune system has here a dual role. Initially dysregulated and could be detrimental, but later on is actually beneficial and is needed for a repair of the brain. So definitely targeting, there's a lot of emphasis on targeting these immune responses to try to, in a time-dependent fashion, maybe you want to target it initially and block the inflammation, but later you want to enhance this reparative phenotype of these immune cells to facilitate recovery.
Yeah, so like hijack the biology's normal way of repair, but in a faster way.
Enhancing it, yes. And there have been some molecules that are important in facilitating the resolution of the inflammation. Interesting, nature is a balance of things, and inflammation starts, and the mediators of the inflammatory response, molecules that are made during the inflammatory response, are the precursors for molecules that are important in the resolution of the inflammation.
So what happens next? What are the therapeutic options for someone after having a stroke?
Unfortunately, there are not very many options clinically, and this is important to know that pharmacologically there is only one option that is approved by the FDA in the US, which is actually a tissue plasminogen activator. It's a drug that basically will help dissolve the clot to facilitate, you know, allow the blood to go back to the region that has been ischemic before. So this is the only treatment pharmacologically that you can give given to stroke patients. However, this treatment is restricted by a very narrow therapeutic window. Basically, a lot of the stroke patients arrive in the hospital several hours after the onset of symptoms. And this agent, which is TPA, can only be given within 4.5 to 6 hours. In some clinical trials have shown that up to 6 hours can be effective.
It's definitely scary to think of a stroke as a ticking time bomb. But the truth is that the sooner you restore blood flow to the brain tissue, the better the chances of recovery. Time seems to be the biggest limiting factor here.
Unfortunately, most of the other therapies that have been tried in clinical trials have failed, and there is a translational roadblock here. And we believe that we know the pathophysiology of a stroke. We know how cells die after injury, right? After the occlusion of the vessel. This has been a study for the last 20 years. However, most of this information comes from animal models, and most of these animal models have been basically using young male rodents that do not, you know, mimic the stroke population. The stroke population is elderly with comorbidities. Most of the stroke patients are hypertensive, diabetic, smoke, are obese. And all these comorbidities on top of, you know, of the stroke are not modeled well in the lab.
Depression and anxiety are common side effects of having a stroke. However, this link is still somewhat of a mystery.
The mechanism through which this happened is not really well established. And there is actually an imbalance of a bunch of neurotransmitters and a lot going on after an injury. But we do know, at least from animal models, that this injury and down the road, basically weeks after the stroke, if the animal recovers, even the motor function, sensory motor function, if the animals recover much better than humans and quicker, they still show signs of depression or anxiety in the test that we actually do for the rodents. Wow. So there are definitely a mechanism through which this is happening that hasn't really been established very well yet.
Scientists like Dr. Candelario Jalil can model strokes in rodents to better understand the consequences of this brain trauma and to hopefully find more therapeutic options. It must be hard since humans have comorbidities that contribute to the effects of a stroke.
So my lab is basically focused on inflammation in a stroke. That's the overall, you know, focus of the lab. And we have different projects trying to tackle the inflammatory response and see if there are targets that we could actually intervene therapeutically to minimize this progression of injury. One of the main projects that is currently going on in the lab is tackling proteins called BET proteins, which are bromodomain and extraterminal domain proteins. It's a family of proteins that are actually important in inflammatory signaling. And we know that if we block those proteins both pharmacologically or with using genetic approaches, we can significantly reduce the amount of tissue that dies after a stroke in animals. And more importantly, we have shown that even if you delay the treatment for 4 to 6 hours after the onset of this ischemic injury, you can still protect the brain, which tells you that this seems to be a target that it's downstream of this, you know, of this critical acute in a process that happened that kills most neurons and initially, but it could potentially be beneficial because if you block the delayed, you know, response, potentially be helpful. Right. These proteins are actually very druggable. Basically, there are specific proteolysis targeting chimeras, which is a class of drug that will produce degradation of the protein in vivo and produce sustained effects rather than having to take it, you know, a drug as an inhibitor all the time. And these are molecules that are pretty effective in reducing the inflammatory response. Mm-hmm. And it's not only from my lab, actually, this is from a lot of other animal models and different inflammatory diseases that have shown to be protective. So cool. We hope that by targeting these bed proteins in a stroke could be any, you know, one of the targets. And another important one is we are have been studying from NIH funding for the last 5 years, a peptide that seems to be important in blood-brain barrier function that is called adropin. And this peptide actually seems to be critical in the maintenance of the permeability of the barrier. If, interestingly, stroke induces a quick degradation of this peptide from the brain, by mechanisms that we are still trying to figure out. But if you lose the peptide, the barrier opens. Basically, this peptide is critical in maintaining an intact blood-brain barrier. And we know from our stroke animal models that if we actually inject the peptide, the synthetic peptide, intravenously to animals after a stroke, we can prevent the opening of the barrier and reduce a injury, and more importantly, improve neurological function.
Wow.
You know, the animals perform better in sensory motor tests and cognitive tests in long term. What is interesting about this peptide is that it's highly conserved among mammals. So basically, the sequence of that peptide in rodents is the exact same as in humans. And in fact, this peptide is circulating in your blood and it's associated with aging and it's associated with injury. So aging significantly reduces the levels of this peptide. This has been shown by us in animals, and our collaborator has shown in humans.
I wonder what it feels like to have a stroke. What makes someone more likely to have one?
The most important non-modifiable risk factor for a stroke is actually age. Mm-hmm. And age is associated with, you know, more propensity to have atherosclerosis, and other modifiable risk factor like high blood pressure, diabetes, etc. And another one is genetics. And there is actually big studies on genetics and genes that contribute to the risk of a stroke. And sex is another important one. Actually, women pre-menopause are protected against a stroke because estrogen is a highly protective hormone. But women post-menopause and people who women that are on a hormone replacement therapy are more prone to have actually strokes, and the stroke severity is higher on women and older females. So young females are protected. In fact, when we model a ischemic stroke in the laboratory, you basically have a hard time inducing strokes in young animals compared to the males, just because of the highly neuroprotective effects of estrogen.
Our age and our genes are some things we can't really control in terms of risk factors for a stroke. I want to know what things I can control.
It's the high blood pressure. The hypertension is one of the key modifiable risk factors for a stroke. And it has been well established that high blood pressure actually exacerbates ischemic brain injury and also in the periphery. And one of these factors that have been, because it's modifiable and you can actually put people on antihypertensives, have made a huge difference. The efforts from the American Heart Association to basically tackle strokes have been very successful, because the U.S. had, you know, number three in the cause of death like 10, 15 years ago. Now it's number five in the U.S. And it's believed that basically the patients are actually, a lot of hypertensive patients are being kept on, you know, and medications to prevent this, the development of other cardiovascular diseases, including a stroke. But worldwide, unfortunately, is still the second common cause of death. So, and the number one common cause of adult disability. So hypertension is a big one as a modifiable risk factor. Diabetes is the second one. So it's kind of the body of literature showing that diabetes exacerbates a stroke injury is overwhelming, and actually controlling the, you know, blood sugars is basically one of the another, you know, area that has got a lot of emphasis. Interventions that are not pharmacological, that are associated from epidemiological studies, associated with less incidence of a stroke, or if you have a stroke, you actually do better and recover better, is exercise, Mediterranean diet, and stuff that we know that is good for you, but not everybody actually follows.
I hope you enjoyed this episode and learned something new. Follow In Your Brain on Twitter and let me know what topic or guest you'd like to hear on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.